You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Emily Larned. Emily, thanks so much for being with me today.
Brainerd, thank you so much for having me.
Emily, let's talk about what you've been doing in the past year. I imagine it's a lot. We're talking in March 2021, so we've been in the pandemic about a year. First time I've said that here, but it's been about what it's been. So, what's been happening? I imagine you have a number of things on your plate.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that we're coming up on a year. So here I am in a room in my house in Stratford, Connecticut, where previously I never spent that much time in. Like we would basically like watch movies here in the evening or like come in here to pick a record. But instead now this has become kind of like my home study, and it's also where I teach a lot out of. When I think back to a year ago, I had just completed a grant to do research in feminist archives kind of all over the country. So I was expecting to be traveling a lot over the summer and, you know, going to these different archives, looking for interesting and really relevant intersectional feminist ephemera that was never really anthologized or made publicly available, and then reissuing those as basically like contemporary art publications, but with contextual material. But, you know, soon it became clear that I wasn't going to be able to travel. And so my focus shifted much more to thinking about Connecticut, which is also where I'm from. Like I grew up in Connecticut. I went to undergrad and graduate school in Connecticut. Now I teach at the University of Connecticut. So I definitely have very deep roots here. And, you know, over the summer, I learned about the Who Governs open call at Artspace New Haven. I know you've talked to Beck Anderson recently, who was also in that show, and spoke a bit about the show and her project. But basically, when I had learned about it, it was over the summer, and in terms of thinking about the theme of who governs and who has power in American cities, I thought, of course, immediately of the police and the role of police brutality and systemic racism and how that was operating. And so I became curious about the intersection between these two things. I was like, well, there was a really, you know, I knew from my research that there was a really strong women's movement in New Haven in the 1970s. And, you know, it's definitely very politically active. Like it wasn't like, you know, the more like myopic feminism that also existed at that time. And so I became curious. I was like, I wonder if there's any overlap between these two. Like, were there feminists who, you know, like somehow demonstrated about the police or worked with the police to change things? Like, was this an issue that was talked about? And I discovered that a woman who was really active, she started a feminist theater company in New Haven in the 70s named Kay Kodis. She went on to direct the New Haven Police Academy from 1992 to 2008, and she essentially turned it into what I call like a socially engaged art school. She would never call it that herself. Obviously, they wouldn't have let her do that if she came in saying, I want to turn the police academy into a feminist art school. But what she had people do is she had potential students do a lot of outreach in the community, and then collaborate with local youth and also artists to present their findings in exhibitions and performances. And she also, you know, was rethinking, you know, one of the most important things is who becomes police. So she totally changed the recruitment that the police department would do, and they specifically recruited women, people of color, and also gays and lesbians, you know, in the 1990s, which I think is pretty exceptional. So I ended up doing this really deep dive into the archive of Kay Kodis, who is still here in Connecticut. And so it's at her house, you know, and so she sent me a packet of material, and then we really started this email correspondence, and I've been fortunate enough to go to her house a few times. We've had some Zoom calls, So basically, my exhibition in ArtSpace was from her archives. Like, it was kind of telling the story visually of what she did in New Haven. And then also, you know, Kay Kodish is also a publisher or like a designer who always designs materials as part of her activism and theater work and at the police department. And so, you know, a lot of her work was actually created by her. So a lot of it was, you know, creating these installations, like these kind of panels of her graphic work that kind of told a story about what was happening at the time. And the show came down in January, but since then we've been working on this interview to kind of provide more context. So I just really finished printing that a week ago, right before the Printed Matter Virtual Art Book Fair this past weekend. So
what did you print? What was that exactly? What was that?
Tell
me about that.
Right. So she. Okay. So there's.
Because this is the book or the zine that the show that kind of culminated all this research, right?
Yeah, that's right. I kind of got off track there. So at the installation, in addition to like the kind of like exploded archive on the wall, I did just like reissue this pamphlet that she had created in 1996. So she had written an article about what she was doing at the police academy, and she sent it to Police Chief Magazine, and it was published. And so, you know, police chiefs all across the country read it in this magazine. But then, for some reason that she couldn't quite recall, she did design it and print it in this pamphlet that also she illustrated. And that is what I reissued. So, you know, she only had like a photocopy of a hard copy that she gave me. I put that on my risograph in my studio and, you know, printed 200 copies, and those were, or 300 copies, and those were at ArtSpace New Haven. So anybody who came and saw the show could take one of those booklets from them. But since then, what we've added to that is like another publication that kind of folds around that one. That's an interview with Kay. And so it's really a conversation between the two of us. A little bit more about her life before the New Haven Police Academy, because she, you know, she was a lifelong activist and experimental theater maker. So we talk a bit about that, but then also, you know, just providing more context about the police academy and what happened after, since that article was from 1996.
So you'll reissue that pamphlet that was in ArtSpace just to be clear about all this, and it'll have a different wrapper on it. That'll be the interview, but essentially what's inside is a reproduction of kind of ephemera, a pamphlet that she did in
that's
the
90s. That's right. It's just like it's different in the color and the paper, but otherwise it's a direct facsimile of what she initially created in the 90s.
Perfect. So just to go a little bit into your show at ArtSpace then, so there was, as you said, kind of an exploded archive on the wall, and there was and there was also this pamphlet. That was the entire show that you had there?
So the only other, that was most of the show. The two other components were there were several vitrines that had actual material from her archives, so the originals, but specifically it would be more things that I hadn't chosen to turn into prints on the wall, where I had selected a number of pieces from her archive, enlarged them, printed them, made these kind of modular tiles where they repeated. But in the actual cases, there was the actual archival material. And I would, you know, open booklets to a certain page or like put certain things next to each other just so you could get like a bit more context from those cases. And then we also had about 30 VHS tapes and a TV and VCR that were training materials from the New Haven Police Academy. So it was everything from like feminist video art, from like women who make movies, to like Hollywood movies about like what the depiction of cops are, to like analysis of how police are affected by toxic masculinity and like those ideas, to like diversity training tapes. So it's a really interesting collection.
And these were all tapes that were actually used for the police?
Yeah.
This is amazing. Like, the research that you're doing is so interesting, and you know that the way you're presenting it is so interesting. There's also this element of, you know, so what happened? I mean, this is all very recent. She's living.
Yeah.
She was an activist. This is with the police department who's still feeling the effects of that. What's happened? Does New Haven have a great police department, or how has that affected it?
Yeah, I certainly shouldn't be the one to speak on this, because I feel like I have a really good grasp up to about 2008 of what was happening in the New Haven Police Academy. But from the best I can understand, you know, in the reason why Kay was hired was because in the early, right around 1990, John C. Daniels, so New Haven's first black mayor, in his election campaign, Tony Harp, who's a black alderwoman in New Haven, who went on to be New Haven's first female mayor, and then also, you know, a senator for 20 years in New Haven. She brought this idea of community policing to Doug Ray, a political sciences professor who was also working on Daniel's campaign. And that was became kind of like the cornerstone of his campaign, of how he transformed the city, was by bringing in community policing. So they hired Nick Pastor to be chief of police, and he's often given the credit for bringing community policing to New Haven because he did do an amazing job of implementing it. So New Haven Police now, from what I can tell, they still very much pride themselves on community policing, but it seems like their preparation, like how they're trained and the recruitment and how they're trained, all those things have totally changed from when Kay was there. You know, it's no longer this kind of like radical training. But the New Haven Police definitely still value community policing very much. But from what I could tell from the summer, it seems like there's a lot of violent tactics that were used, a lot of aggression, like with the demonstrations for Black Lives. It seems like there was a lot of conflicts with the police and their methods. So the sort of demilitarized approach that Kay implemented in the academy, I don't see that in contemporary policing in New Haven. But again, I'm certainly not an expert. I wasn't there on the streets.
Whether it resulted in something tangible or quantifiable now, it's that she did that, and that was that had an impact then, and it was a pioneering way of thinking and working with the police, right?
Right. Yeah. So that was, you know, and the you know the police force did become incredibly much more diverse. So like when she started, it was something like 3% female, and then even within just a few years, it became like 14% female, and it used to be very white and male, and now it is much more diverse. And that happened really quickly over her tenure, and I believe that is still very true about the New Haven Police Department. It's very diverse, and they definitely have an emphasis on recruiting from within the city, like recruiting residents. Again, I don't know how much, it's not a requirement, but it's definitely something that they look for. So again, this idea that, you know, the police come from the community. It's not somebody outside coming in.
Right. That's so interesting. It's such a fascinating project. I want to ask you just about also your history with zines, right? We're talking about a pamphlet you're making,
let's
talk about zines a little bit. Are you making them now? We could talk about ones you have made, but I love zines. And so tell me about your relationship to that.
Yeah. So zines is how, you know, that's really where I date the beginning of my, really just like my artistic practice. Like I think basically what I do now is the same as what I did when I was 16 in the early 1990s and started publishing zines. So I really think of my work as publishing as like a socially engaged artistic practice. And so for me, what was so amazing about zines, so I started making a zine called Muffin Bones when I was like 16, and then later one called Memory Time USA, and then one called Parfait. But what was
and so what were in those
about
zines?
Them,
these were early zines.
Oh, they're very
teenager.
Personal. Yeah, they were like personal zines, like really about my life. And then I would trade them mostly with other generally, I'd say other young women around my age. I'd say that was mostly like my zine friends. But just the fact that like kind of pre-internet, you could build this community of people where you knew people throughout the country and sometimes around the world who you felt this really close affinity with, and you knew so much about each other's lives without ever having actually met or talked on the phone or seen each other. You know, it was a really transformative experience. And just like all the
because
things
you're exchanging
culture,
these emails, these were Xerox on
right.
the bond paper
right.
and
Xerox,
folded in staples.
Right.
And
yep, and just sent through the mail to someone's home address. You know, and at the time in the 90s, a big part of zine culture too was reviewing the zines that you got. So basically, once you found a zine that you liked, if you then went to the back of the zine, there would generally be say like 10 to 20 reviews of other zines that person liked. So if you liked that zine, probably in the back page, there's probably about at least 15 other zines that you're really going to like too. And so that's kind of how you'd find out about other zines. It was very word of mouth, very egalitarian, and just like the DIY culture that came out of that, like booking shows or just this idea that you could create your own culture, like that became really important to me. And that really directly fed into my other main project. So this feminist, you know, the Kay Kodish project is part of like a feminist reissue project. And that's one of the main things I work on these days. So I'm currently thinking about developing that into more of a book. But then the other thing that is a main project of mine is called Impractical Labor, when its full name is Impractical Labor in Service of the Speculative Arts. And that is an artist membership organization. That's a collaboration with my friend Bridget Elmer, who lives down in Florida. And that is really a direct outgrowth of zines. Like basically we make these call and response publications that we send to our members. And then those become other exhibitions or events or opportunities to gather. We've been running a residency at one of our members' residencies the past 2 years. We had a remote residency this past summer because of COVID, just kind of like an interesting experiment. But yeah, this is, you know, for me, zines, it's like not just the artifact of actually writing and making and like crafting this thing, but then it's also like the distribution aspects and how each, when you make just a small number of publications, it's like each publication becomes kind of a relationship. Like whoever gets that, you know, when there's only like 100 or 200, it becomes a small kind of pool of people that then kind of grows when they give it to someone. You know, so it just feels very human scale, I guess.
So let's talk a little bit about that, the impractical labor in service of the speculative arts. This is, like you're saying, a union for artists and makers, right? How do people
That's
join
right.
and how do they, what does it cost? How do people join?
Right.
By invitation or how does that work?
So it's totally, it's completely open. So the website is impractical-labor.org, so impractical labor, and anyone is welcome to join who is interested in joining. Membership itself is free. So if you just want to join and join the listserv and kind of like keep up to date with what's happening that way, a lot of the calls we do, there's some way to participate online, you know, so you don't have to get the mail aspect. If you do wish to get the print publications in the mail and participate that way, often, you know, there might be like a form to fill out or like a thing to make that with materials that come in the mail, and then those are returned and those become an exhibition. That level of membership is $20 a year if you're in the U.S. and $25 if you're in Canada or Mexico and $35 if you're international. So it's very affordable. This is definitely, you know, a long time labor of love for me and Bridget, but I think it's also just a way of really maintaining our friendship since we've been doing this since 2008, and we've always been far apart from each other in producing this collaboration. So it seems almost like it's a COVID friendly structure, but it actually, you know, it really comes from like the zine culture of just the mail and collaborating long distance, that kind of thing. So to date, we've had about, I'd say maybe about like 450 people join. Some people stay on year after year and like keep on renewing or keep on participating. Sometimes people kind of drift in and out. Right now, I think we have about 200 current members, but like the number of people who participate in any given project also really varies. Like sometimes it's more like 50. Although we recently just did a commissioned project for the Aldrich where we made them a ballot for 2020. So it was like a handset type letterpress printed ballot that people received in the mail, and they got to reflect upon all the rhetoric of the 2020 election, but then also dream a bit about what they wish was actually on the ballot, like what they actually would like to see change in the world. And that there was about, I think there are 110 of those that were sent out that were then just about all of them were returned to the museum, which is amazing. Normally we get more like like if we get half back, we're normally pretty excited, but that was a really high level of return.
So those were pretty,
that was cool.
Letterpress. So we were talking about like early zines and they're on copy machines. You're using letterpress now as well as other forms?
Right. So that's the in-between part of my foray into publishing. So both Bridget and I are letterpress printers. So I have a studio here in Bridgeport. It's just a couple miles from my house. And so I have a Vandercook there, and I have several tons of type and a paper cutter and a risograph. So I do all that stuff in-house myself. Like it's never actually, you know, paying somebody else to print something. It's generally I do all that printing in person. So I think like and that was always part of Impractical Labor too. It actually started as a membership organization for people who use obsolete technology in experimental or speculative ways. But then with time, it kind of morphed more into a union for reflective creative practice. Like we realized we had a lot of people who were interested in what we were doing, but they didn't necessarily work with obsolete technology. And we just realized it didn't really matter. You know, like it was more about an opportunity to think about what and why and how of your practice. It doesn't really matter how you're actually doing that. It's just that for us, it was important to often engage these technologies because of how they slow you down. You know, they can be more sustainable. It's a much more long-term relationship as opposed to like a computer or phone that you have to replace every 5 years or so. You know, my Vandercook I've had since 2001, I think now. So just about 20 years.
Wow, that's a Vandercook proof press?
Yeah. It's a SB15. Yeah, so it's about like, you know, 800 pounds, little flatbed press.
That's exciting. So one last question about this. So there's union members that are also listed on your site, and these are all people who are artists that are involved in social practice, or is there a certain demographic of the people that are members? Are they other publishers? Are they into zine culture, or who are they?
Yeah, great questions. I know it's so complicated to try to explain it really quickly.
Yeah, you're doing it though.
on the union page, we ask all our members for something we can link to for them, and a lot of people don't get back to us. So it's definitely not a comprehensive list of everyone on that website, but you still get anybody who has given us a link is listed there. And so as you can see, it's maybe like 38 states and a handful of countries where we have members. Mm-hmm. I would say we probably do have a lot of members who are printmakers or bookmakers or artist publishers of some kind or zine people. But then we also have we have many members who are artists or makers or writers, poets. We've had sign painters, fiber artists, comic book artists, filmmakers. So really, I'd say a really wide spectrum. Basically, you know, anybody who basically goes to our weirdo website and is like, oh, this sounds cool, like I'm intrigued, they are more than welcome to join.
Okay, let me ask you the last question. What are you reading at the moment?
So So I do quite a lot of handwork, and I also drive back and forth to stores to teach. So I listen to a lot of audiobooks. And so the audiobook I'm listening to right now is Cassandra Speaks by Elizabeth Lesser. And it's a really wonderful book about looking back at myths and storytelling and kind of imagining what if things were told from like the woman's perspective, like what would Pandora's perspective be, or Eve's perspective, you know, like and valuing, basically like valuing women's voices and experiences in these old stories.
That sounds interesting. Thanks so much. Emily, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been exciting and interesting to talk with you. I wish you good luck on your upcoming work.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me today.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.